Paddy Power and the Football Show, the greatest football partnership since Diofen Heskey.
Now then, you're very welcome back. So, to say the least, this is a huge week for the Irish team as they try and reach the European Championships. They play Greece this Thursday, 7:15 at the Talas Stadium. And then on Wednesday, the 11th of March, they are away to Montenegro. And I'm delighted to say that the Republic of Ireland manager, Vera Pauw, has made time for us on what I'm sure is a very busy week. Vera, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. It's a great week.
A great week, exactly. You have to enjoy the pressure these weeks.
Yes, and the players do also. You can feel it in the camp. Everybody is so sharp and is so ready to go on that pitch. And that's also thanks to all the promotion and all the attention that we get. And the players know that this is a very crucial game and that we have to win. So it's fantastic. That is what top sport is about, and that is what you're looking for, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I'm sure as a player, and you were a player of huge experience as well now as being a manager, as a player on those bigger weeks, those bigger occasions, World Cups, European Championships, you probably often had your better performances.
Yeah. The best players are always pushed to their best under the highest pressure. So we have many of them. We have many players who are playing at their best under the highest pressure. And that is actually the first time that I have that in a squad. That they're players, and I called them a bit funny that our Tigers, but that is what they are. The moment that they have to be there, they are there. In the away game against Greece, we had many injuries. We missed five basic lineup players, and KD was playing on the fullback, so actually six players on different positions. Which meant that the routines were not there as usual. But you can see this week with everybody back in that it's just such a vibe and such a pleasure to work with them. And so looking forward to the game. Yeah. And especially because we now just heard that there's already 5,300 tickets being sold. That's, again, going up today. And there's still a few tickets left for the people. Not many anymore, so people have to be fast. But this time, everybody paid for it in packages or single tickets. So we do hope that everybody is turning up, and that would mean another record of attendance. And that in itself is boosting us also so much, because we need the support of the players. We need them to be loud. We need them to support the moments that we need them. And I'm absolutely sure that that atmosphere will even push our performance further up.
Yeah, I've no doubt. And there was a brilliant atmosphere for the 3-2 win at home to Ukraine. And
yeah.
I fully suspect if people have paid for the tickets this time around, they will be there. So again, it's a 7:15 kickoff at Talas Stadium. This game is going to be live on television. Just to remind listeners of where we are in Group 1, the table, Germany after four games are on 12 points. They are an excellent side. Ireland after three games are on 7 points. Greece after three games are on 4 points. And it's Greece obviously coming to town this Thursday. So the importance of this game, Montenegro and Ukraine, both on 0 points. This is the key game really, Vera. I mean, a draw, not a disaster, but it really, you win this game and it puts Ireland in a fantastic position with Germany to come twice in future fixtures.
Yeah, you summarized perfectly. That's exactly the case. It's if we draw, then we're not out. But then we really have to win away in Ukraine, although we doubt if Ukraine will take all the points as well. Ukraine is on 0 points because they played Germany twice and us once. So they will gain the points later in the campaign.
Yeah.
But it's right. We have to win to be comfortable. And we're absolutely ready for that.
I watched the 1-1 draw away to Greece, and an away draw against Greece with the injuries, as you mentioned, is a perfectly acceptable result. But it struck me when you did your pitch side interview immediately after the game, there was certainly disappointment there. And you talked about this team having to learn to control games as a group. And the Ukraine game at home, the 3-2 win, that was a game that Ireland should have been more in control of as well. I mean, it was fantastic for the spectator, but I'm sure it wasn't good for your heart rate. So talk to us about how quickly a team can learn to control a game, because that must be one of the more difficult things to teach.
Yeah, and definitely it's also very difficult because it's been 4 months away since we've seen each other. Yeah. But on the other hand, everybody's so focused. We have so much quality in the team. You can see the team growing every minute that we're together. And that is, we're just off the pitch now and walking back with the staff. We said, it's amazing if we play like this. We've not seen that before yet. So the team is growing every single day. And that is, yeah, again, such a joy to work with. But on the other hand, it gives so much trust in Thursday that we will be there. We will be ready. And if that is not enough, then we have to be honest. But we think that it is enough to steam through to become second in the group. We truly believe that we can do that. And of course, then you need to, yeah, you need to see what's happening in the playoff draw. But we think that we are only growing, and that from where the team was, they grew already so much over the last few years that we're only kicking up. And we think that, yeah, that Thursday you will see the result of a lot of hard work and a lot of concentration, especially of the players.
How do the Irish women's team compare technically on the ball? Keeping the ball. How do we compare to other European countries, for instance, Vera?
The only thing that differs is that we have not qualified yet, because the moment we qualify for finals, you will see that the game will take just another step. I've had the same process in the Netherlands before in Scotland. With South Africa, exactly the same process. The team needs to qualify, because if you're there and you learn to play those huge games in a huge tournament under huge pressure, you grow so much in a few weeks, you don't give that out of hands anymore. So that is the only thing. We have to qualify. And after you've qualified once, you come in another group, you come in another pot for the draw, you come with against other opponents. And that means that you're really kicking off to a great future.
Okay, so you get momentum and time together as well.
Yeah, but it's especially the games that you play. You mature so fast from a tournament that the next campaign, that's in your legs and in your head and in the team and in everything that you perceive. So my experience is that after that happens, the team is flying. Mm-hmm. Look where the Netherlands is now. It took us 25 years to get to the point of qualifying. And after we qualified, within a few years, we became the finalist of the World Cup and European champions within 4 years. Mm. So, it is. That's what you need, because players get recognized, players get other contracts, players get another position, another status, but especially better opponents to play, stronger opponents to play, and you grow so fast from that.
Okay. A question I wanted to ask you, actually, and it's probably a complicated answer, so, do your best. But, the way, for instance, people are would be more familiar, for instance, say, with the male game, and they would know what Brazilian football is like and what Spanish football is like, and the Dutch football has an identity, and the Irish football has an identity. Now, I don't know why the Dutch play such beautiful football, or the Brazilians play the type of football they do, or Ireland, mm-hmm. or why Irish footballers play the football they do. I presume there are lots of factors, physical, cultural, geographical, the weather, any number of things. Is the style of football in the women's game, does it tend to match up to what their male counterparts play? Do the Dutch women and the Dutch men play a similar brand, or is it very different across male and female sport?
It's a very nice question, because I usually don't get those questions. In the past, it was that everybody was trying to copy the United States in the women's game. So that meant everybody was trying to get very, very thick, strong legs and just power in the team and running and flying. But now the game has grown to a professional game on different positions in the world. It has grown to a game that indeed carries the culture of the country. So the Brazilian national team becomes more and more like the men's Brazilian national team. The Dutch national team plays more like the style of the men's national team. And that is the same for Germany and France and Italy and Spain. And that is so good to see, because that means that the young female players get good education and a good development pathway. Before that wasn't the case, and we were copying each other. But now the development pathway is there, the culture is there as well. And you can really see the different cultures on the pitch now, and you can recognize the teams on the style of play.
Okay.
And that shows that the game has come into a mature state, and it's just getting more players professional, getting better coaches along the sideline, getting better programs for the players to grow to, well, the same level as the men's game. And level in playing style, and that I don't mean in money and in the numbers of crowd in the stadiums. Mm. But if you look at the World Cup and the viewers on TV, that's exactly the same as the men. And most games were even more than light games of the men's World Cup.
Yeah.
More viewers. So people recognize it as football, and they just want to be part of it.
Yeah, no, it really was amazing to see it last year, how someone like, I don't know, Megan Rapinoe can become famous the world over and have that impact. Was that the best quality World Cup that we've seen in the women's game, yeah?
Actually, no. And from marketing point of view, yes. From filled stadiums, yes. From everything around and the number of countries broadcasting, yes. But 2011 has been the best World Cup, content-wise.
Right.
And that had to do that back then all the street footballers were in the teams. And now we had a phase that many players did not have a good development system. Now young players are coached and are developing from a very young age to top-level football. So that will change very much. I think that next World Cup, both the level of play and the marketing are level, and that is absolutely top football from all the teams, and not only from a few teams.
Okay. So does it follow that the coached footballers from a young age working on very nice pitches with very nice coaches and very nice footballs, do they turn out to be better footballers than the street footballers?
Yeah, that's also a nice question. You don't know. For about 8 years, we're missing the street footballers. And luckily, we have at least 2-3 in our squad now.
Okay.
That doesn't mean that others have never played on the street, but the real street footballers we have in the squad. And there's many teams that don't have them anymore because of the traffic and because of keeping kids inside and because of the overcoaching of players. But on the other hand, if players get a chance to play, and if they play especially a lot with boys and against boys and train with boys, then that will develop by itself and it will come back into our game.
Okay. Because when I think of the street footballers in Irish football recently, I think of Wes Houlihan and Robbie Keane. And it's so obvious to everyone. You know, you can spot the street footballer. Who are the street footballers in the Irish women's team at the moment?
Well, everybody knows them. Denise O'Sullivan, Katie McCabe, those kind of players. They have grew between boys. And Tyler Toland is another one. She's not in the squad, but she will be back. They grew from the street to teams, and they bring something extra.
Mm.
And it doesn't mean that others have not been playing on the street with boys or against boys, but you can definitely see that they grew the start of their game on playing with boys on the street.
Okay. Vera, people will know you're very experienced. You're 89 caps with the Dutch team. I think you were the first Dutch professional footballer, and then as a manager, you led the Netherlands to the European Championship semi-finals in 2009. You've coached Russia, Scotland, South Africa. Are you enjoying your time in Ireland? How have you found it?
Very much, very much. People think that this is like this is not the same challenge. Well, it's the double challenge because I've never worked with a team that is so open and so up for it, and they just fight their way through to gain the status and to gain the momentum and to get what they want, and that is qualifying for a final.
Yeah.
And there's no moaning in the team. Everybody is concentrated, mature, is working together, is having fun together, and that is just amazing. I've never had this kind of atmosphere in any team that I've coached.
Okay, that's good to hear. What challenge will Greece pose then? What kind of team are Greece?
Greece is nasty, a bit mean, to be honest. So we have Spanish referees, and we truly hope that that they can cope with that, because away we had some troubles with, to be honest, that it went a bit too far and nobody was stopping them. They have a few very good footballers, but we have more quality in our team. We have better teamwork in the sense of variety in our play. But they fight to the end. They fight to the 95th minute if necessary, and they keep going and going and going, especially when they see that they can get something. So it will be a very difficult game. It will not be easy, but I am confident that we have more qualities, and with the support of the crowd, it will lift us to such a height that I'm very confident that we can have a good result in the Telex Stadium.
And what is the advice to the players if Greece are that little bit nasty and the referees aren't quite controlling it? I presume at a certain stage in football, you have to fight fire with fire.
No, we will fight fire with a smile. That's what we have agreed with each other. We will fight them with a smile. So we just turn around and we smile.
Okay, don't get wound up, don't get involved.
Exactly. Because that is not our play, and the only thing what we would get from it is yellow cards. Because it's not our play. Mm. That's why I enjoy it so much, to play with the players, and I don't want the players to act any differently. So we said to each other we better smile than that we are going to fire things up.
Okay, very good. Well, as you said, 5,300 tickets sold for the game. It's on this Thursday. It's at Tallaght Stadium. We wish you all the very best. This is a huge game, and we really hope the crowd are up for it. I'm sure the players will be. And the very best of luck, Vera, on a busy week.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Paddy Power and the Football Show. The greatest football partnership since Diofen Heskey.
Fabinho is still just trying to get back to the general pitch of things. He's lunged in late there on young Mason Mount and received a yellow card. And it's been a bad evening, Nathan Murphy, hello, for Fabinho. He combined beautifully with Adrian to give away the first and only goal of this game at Stamford Bridge.
Yeah, and his return to the Liverpool team has very much coincided with them conceding a lot of goals.
Yeah.
And Jordan Henderson's injury on top of that. So an hour gone, Chelsea leading Liverpool by 1-0. As you say, it was a bad mistake from Fabinho initially, which gifted the ball to Willian. He shoots straight at Adrian, who somehow turns the ball into his own net. Liverpool have had their chances, but it's a very open game. It's been very end-to-end entertaining stuff. Chelsea have a free kick now because of that foul by Fabinho, where again, not dissimilar to the goal, he's just a split second off. Mm. Everything's just not quite there. So this is a really good opportunity. Marcos Alonso's generally brilliant from this sort of range. The Barkley standing there, Mason Mount is on off the bench. It's what? 25, 26 yards out, just to the left of centre. A big moment. If Chelsea can go 2-0 up, you'd imagine that's probably that for Liverpool. Mason Mount is the one they're very much zooming in on at the moment. All three of them standing over with a little bit of menace. Feels like it's Ross Barkley, 15 yards over the bar sort of territory. If I got to be honest with you, Barkley steps up, steps over. Mason Mount, oh, off the crossbar. Mason Mount it was in the end. Barkley ran up, looked as though he was going to hit it, steps over, Mount right footed, real good power, good dip, and it just clips the top of the crossbar and over.
Fairness to Ross Barkley, a very nice dummy.
Mm.
Often not enough animation when the dummy runner runs over the football. Some lads just trot up, never going to kick and keep on going.
It's like when you have a left footed player and a right footed player, and the left footed player just is the laziest. What's the point of you even being there?
Be physically impossible for you to kick a ball with that run-up.
Yeah.
So, Nathan, Wales. We've had enough of Wales again. Ireland will meet Wales in the Nations League. Coming up, by the way, in the Football Show, Kevin Kilbane will explain the Nations League format to you, if you didn't catch it first time around. And we'll go over to Raphael Honigstein. Interesting scenes between Bayern Munich and Hoffenheim at the weekend. But 5 o'clock Irish time this evening, the Nations League draw made. Luis Figo looking incredibly well.
Sensational. We had Luis Figo on the show last year on a random Saturday afternoon. He was in Dublin, which we're going to see a lot of, I'd imagine, over the next few months. A lot of legendary, well, maybe not with the way things are going, but we should hopefully see a lot of legendary football figures arriving in because of Euro 2020.
Yeah.
And he was in for some launch. He was meant to come into studio and it ended up being a 10-minute phone piece.
Not as good.
Not quite as good. And so obviously you're told you have 10 minutes with Luis Figo. You got to focus on one thing. So let's think Portugal-Ireland 2001. Unfortunately, Luis doesn't have the same memories of these games that we do. It's like, obviously not your first trip to Dublin. That time? No, there was no great.
Goal.
2-0, Ross Barkley.
Just the much maligned Ross Barkley after Nathan Murphy hammered him a few months ago, and I felt he had a goal in him. 63 minutes on the clock. Chelsea 2, Liverpool 0, and exuberant celebrations. Camera cuts to Van Dijk, he's trying to rally the troops. Chelsea looking very happy. Alonso over there, Barkley, Mason Mount. They're cutting to Trent Alexander-Arnold, so I wonder, was he at fault? I didn't see the goal, I just saw the net, ball, rustling, all that kind of stuff. It's Liverpool in possession, and they give it away. Good pressing from Chelsea. Ball falls to Barkley in his own half. He's got acres to run into, and in fairness, if there's one thing he can do, it's that. So he runs really the length of the entire half, gets to the semicircle D edge of the area, and decent strike. I mean, I want to see it from another angle to see if we can blame goal number two on Adrian, but looks like a good strike. And Perel Fabinho trying to sprint with him was never going to catch him.
No, it's a brilliant finish from Ross Barkley. It was inadvertently put into his path, albeit pretty much on the halfway line, by a header by Virgil van Dijk. And it's the sweetest of strikes because it hits the camera that's placed right at the bottom corner. Yeah. But you would have thought, because Fabinho's been booked, he can't foul him. Doesn't seem to have the pace. So Fabinho booked just a couple of minutes ago, you would do your tactical slash cynical foul ordinarily. But he's been booked, so he knows he'd be sent off if he does. Didn't look like he had the pace, really, to keep with him. But this is maybe what Kenny Cunningham touches on all the time, why he much prefers Henderson in that role. That Henderson doesn't find himself chasing the ball. He finds himself in the right spot all the time. You often see when teams are bearing down in Liverpool that Van Dijk and Gomez have a certain way of defending and they hold back for as long as possible. That time it was Gomez who was almost in the left-hand side, Van Dijk's position, and he held off and held off. And by the time he gets across, Barkley takes a shot and it's too late. There was nothing the keeper could have done at all.
It's the kind of rampaging, bullish goal that Barkley probably scored in his youth, and everybody thought, we've got the next Wayne Rooney here, and hasn't done enough of since, but a brilliant goal as things stand. 65 minutes on the clock. Where were we? Oh, yes.
Luis Figo. It was the dullest interview of all. It was one of those that you've just had Luis Figo on the show, and by the end of the show, I was going, I don't think I'll mention that.
Yeah. Did he remember the game at all?
No real memory. No standout moments.
Roy Keane's goal, Luis?
No, nothing. Nothing. Yeah. Well, may not get him over for a roadshow.
He's aging incredibly well, I have to say. So that was the big
takeaway. Chance for three. Pedro clear through and goal. Gomez going to get back. Pedro shoots straight at Adrian. He brought the ball. Somehow Liverpool have pushed so far up. The ball is played through to Pedro inside his own half. Yeah. He's clear through and goal from inside his own half. Brings it forward 40, 50 yards. The legs are going. Gomez is getting back quickly. Shoots from about 25 yards out. Adrian's out and he blocks it.
Chelsea to score another goal on the break is our tip of the evening thus far. So Luis Figo dipped his beautiful tanned hands into the bowls and picked out Netherlands, Italy. It's a good group. Bosnia-Herzegovina and Poland. England are in with Belgium and Denmark. Must say, I'm relieved not to see Denmark anytime soon. England, Belgium, Denmark and Iceland. We have Portugal, France, Sweden, Croatia and Switzerland, Spain, Ukraine, Germany. They're the better groups. Ireland are in with Finland, Bulgaria, Wales. Finland 58th in the world, Bulgaria 59th, Wales 23 in the world, and we're 34th.
Nations League is a great competition when you look at League A, because you find yourself on a Thursday night if Ireland are playing on the Friday, and you could sit down and suddenly Portugal and France are on, and they're taking it pretty seriously.
Yeah.
All the stars are out. Portugal and France in the same group for Euro 2020 as well.
I mean, it's less of a big deal for those bigger sides because they're most likely going to qualify through the traditional route anyway, but you still get some really good games. Ireland and Wales, obviously, the top two in our group. Wales are a better team than us, it feels like.
Wales definitely right now have a better quality of player.
Yeah.
But from when we think back to the 2018 qualifying campaign where we were obsessed with Gareth Bale. Gareth Bale isn't the player he was 2 years ago, 3-4 years ago. You don't expect him to come to a game in Dublin now and just absolutely dominate.
Certainly short on game time.
But they have overall, even with the likes of Harry Wilson coming through, got the free kick obviously.
The game where Ampadu looked like,
Ampadu does look again like a player because he was really struggling in Germany at times. They were playing him centre back and was struggling to get his game this season, but in the last few months has come right back into it. Shaved the head, got rid of the dreadlocks. Maybe it was the best thing for him.
I can't say I approve of that. I like the dreadlocks.
I did like the dreadlocks as well. But it's a whole new era. Like Stephen Kenny, these are going to be his first games in charge. We should find out the actual fixtures over the next hour or so as to what the flow of them is going to be. So it'll be two games September, two October, to November, and then just after that, the draw will take place for the World Cup 2020 qualifiers. But if you can get Bulgaria, Finland in those first couple of games, I think Stephen Kenny will be very happy. He doesn't know, like, they could be his first, if Ireland qualify, they'll actually be his first games in charge. There'll be no friendlies. If they don't qualify, he'll have probably quite a few games in come the summer.
Yeah,
definitely playing Turkey, definitely playing Luxembourg. I'd imagine they'll add in a few more.
Yeah,
if Stephen Kenny wants to get the players together, it's not the worst group. If you win that group, you put yourself in a good position for the World Cup qualifiers in terms of seedings for the initial draw and for the chances of getting a playoff, which is going to be incredibly difficult to get through. If it goes badly wrong, and you're struggling against Finland and Bulgaria and Stephen Kenny's first game in charge, it's like, it is going to be difficult. There will be criticism, there will be questions, all of that. But what we saw at Bulgaria, like, they were an absolute mess.
They seem to have gone to pieces, yeah.
Like, you look through, it's hard to think of a Bulgarian player right now who's playing at an elite level club. Like, you look at Slovakia, so many of those players are playing in Serie A. Like, Milan Škriniar at Inter Milan is one of the most highly rated centre backs in Europe. They have a lot of players playing at a high level. Bulgaria don't.
Yeah. By the way, Bobby Firmino coming on for Liverpool, as is James Milner, with 20 minutes to go. So it's not like Jurgen Klopp is waving the white flag just yet in this game. They are 2-0 down if you're just tuning in. On the Slovakian game, two pieces of news today. Seamus Coleman out. You'll get your Matt Doherty wish, Nathan. By hook or by crook, you'll get it.
Well, I would like to have seen both of them in the team.
Well, that was never going to happen, so you'll get your Matt Doherty wish.
Mm.
And the other piece of news, UEFA intend to make a, quote, last-minute decision on all the international fixtures, all the playoffs. They had their annual congress in Amsterdam today. Like every sporting organisation, they can't make decisions now. Everybody's holding their breath to see how this thing plays out. So they're liaising with the WHO, they're liaising with respective governments. Switzerland have banned public gatherings of over 1,000 people, by the way. All of their football at the moment postponed. Cases now in Vienna, Prague and Slovakia is coming under the spotlight as well. Who knows? Behind closed doors would be an advantage for Ireland. I mean, Irish fans would love to travel over and have the trip there. But behind closed doors, when you're away from home, would actually work out quite nicely for Ireland.
Oh, absolutely. Like, it does again raise the question, which we'll see this weekend in Ireland, where you hear a lot of the hoteliers are concerned as to how they protect their staff, because the Italian supporters, a huge amount of them, are still coming, even though the game
Six
is cancelled.
Nations game, yeah.
And there's not a hope in hell, even if that game is played behind doors, that 99% of Irish supporters who have their tickets and have their travel plans arranged won't travel to Slovakia anyway. So you're going to have a pub full of 300 or 400 Irish supporters. You'd have to question how much more safe it is. But they'll obviously go by the advice, and it does, by the sound of it, like, it's obviously escalating rapidly.
Yeah.
It could be a very much 2-3 days beforehand to decide this.
Mick McCarthy was there today.
Lucky Mick, eh?
So here's some what Mick had to say and what he made of the draw, which obviously will have no bearing on his future as our Irish manager.
Mick will be back in punditry mode.
Sorry, yeah, okay. So here's a glimpse of Mick McCarthy, pundit, talking about these games.
Well, Mick, what are your thoughts on this Nations League draw?
My thoughts are strange, of course, because I'm not going to be doing it.
Yep.
I won't be there. Stephen Kenny will be doing it. And I think if Stephen sat at home and watched it, I think he'd be happy with it. I know I would be if I was there looking, think I was going to take it with the games. Wales are the standout team, qualified for the 16 and 2020 Euros. Ryan's doing a great job with them, so they're the best side. We played Bulgaria in a friendly, we beat them, albeit it was two completely changed teams. Finland I don't know much about, but I think it's a group that we can win.
What can teams take from this tournament and this format in particular?
Well, I was the cynical old pro thinking they were just going to be glorified friendlies when the Nations League came out, and it wasn't. I thought they were brilliant. I mean, the games that England had against Croatia and Spain, was it, and Germany and Holland, there were some fantastic fixtures. You know, overall, I thought it was a rip-roaring success, so I expect the next one to be.
How are your preparations going ahead of this crucial playoff semi-final later this month?
Preparations are going fine. I mean, what can we do? I can't go and watch Slovakia play live. We're in at Abbottstown, our training centre. Myself and TC and Joe Dunn, our analyst, looking at it, looking at the teams they played against, looking at them, looking at the players, how they play. if it goes to penalties, who takes penalties, what does the keeper do, all the things that we, you know, their free kicks, their corners, all the stuff you do in the analysis. And we'll be back in next week to have another look. So prep's going all right, but, you know, it's the build-up to it. We'll meet on Sunday, on the 21st. We train on Monday. Bearing in mind, players normally are cooling down still and having rest days. We train Tuesday and we travel. We play on Thursday, so we've had this November to March, and then you get 4 days to prepare for it.
I must say, I always think Mick McCarthy comes across very well. Anytime you meet him as well, he's a thoroughly decent fella. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's funny, he talks there about what can you do when you're watching a team, and one of the things is watch a goalkeeper, watch penalties. I don't know, did you see Jared Bowen's goal for West Ham at the weekend?
Yeah.
So he dinked it over the keeper without looking. And then in the post-match interview on Match of the Day, generally those tell us about the goal questions don't amount to much. You know, somebody done great, whipped it in and got my head to it. Whereas he was saying that somebody had been scouting the keeper during the week and told him that the keeper often goes down early.
Right.
So when he was in the position where he didn't have much time to look up, he figured, if I scoop this, there's a chance. And it worked out perfectly. So it's a fantastic finish, but he never looked up. He never looked to see if the keeper had gone down.
He just assumed he was.
Yeah.
It was funny because I watched...
Based on the lads, you draw the parallel, in Abbottstown, watching Slovakia in so much as they can.
I was thinking watching Sarr's goal for Watford, the second one, which he dinked over Alisson.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, that's not what you should do against Alisson because he's so good. He always, generally, stands so tall and gets his hands up. But for once, actually... It worked out, but I would imagine that's not the plan generally when you're up against Alisson, because in those sort of situations, he's brilliant. Mick McCarthy, at this stage, work on your own team, get your own plan together. Like, do Ireland know exactly what they're about? Does he know what his preferred formation is, even still? Like, does he know his starting 11 right now? It's hard to know. He has a couple of injuries, obviously. Enda Stephens should be back. Like, if McLean returns, now that Coleman is injured, and Doherty will play right back.
Yeah.
McLean on the left, Callum Robinson on the right, and Dave McGoldrick through the middle.
Yeah.
With a midfield of, which maybe one of the more interesting is what he'll do with Conor Howran, who's not really playing any football at the moment, the odd minute or two off the bench.
And James McCarthy as well.
Well, that'll be the most interesting aspect of the squad when it's announced. Mm. Is McCarthy in it? Mick McCarthy would have to assume wants him there. He's spoken about him in these little scouting reports that get sent out and speaks very positively. It's very different to back in November when we heard Stephen Doyle talking to McCarthy after a Palace match, and you sense McCarthy didn't really want to be there. Mick McCarthy confirmed that he just wants to stay with his club. He wants to get a run of games, which he hadn't had in 4 years almost at this stage, which was, I think, understandable at the time, even if Mick did want him to come in and play against New Zealand. But he could transform things.
Mm. The way he's playing now, he could.
The way he's playing right now, it might mean a slight shift in terms of, generally we assume McCarthy plays at the base of midfield. Mm. Glenn Whelan's going to play there.
I think McCarthy has played his best football at the base of midfield, but I agree, Glenn Whelan will start.
Glenn Whelan will start. So do you then go for, I think Hendrick will start. So is it Howrahan or McCarthy? He likes Alan Brown. Could he play in that role? Mm-hmm. So there's a couple of little decisions, but you would like to see, I don't think there's much point bringing James McCarthy if you're not going to play him. It's obviously potentially two games, but like, bring him, play him, start him.
Yeah,
he definitely, you would imagine, should give you a little bit more control in the middle of midfield in a slightly different role to he's used to.
Yeah, well, we'll see how it plays out. Later on, we'll talk to Raphael Honigstein. We will hear from Ryan Giggs as well. We're going to take a very short ad break, and then Kevin Kilbane will fulfil his duties as Nations League correspondent.
Paddy Power and the Football Show, the greatest football partnership since Diouf and Heskey.
Jurgen Klopp really going after it now. Mo Salah's coming on with 10 minutes to go, so they're having a go. 2-0 down at Stamford Bridge. We were talking Nations League before the ad break there. Obviously, it's a complicated business, the Nations League.
Do you want me to explain it to you, Joe, or have you got an expert on?
I don't doubt that you couldn't, but I just feel, first time around, we nailed this.
Okay.
And I think it's important that we try and nail this again, Nations League style.
I've got everything in front of me, so I think I have it. It took me a while to get there.
Okay.
A few of the lads in there earlier on, but I think I've got it. Yeah. The league split up into four different leagues: League A, B, C, and D. If you win a group, you automatically get into a playoff for Euro 2020 by winning a group.
What?
Yeah. So if you win your group, so if we had, say, Wales and Northern Ireland, we then, I think it comes down to, so if you win, if we win League B,
yeah.
And now, not necessarily, but if say you win all the games, potentially, that gives you the chance, you've topped that group. That's how it would work.
So basically, the top four teams in each league, so the one from each group, will go forward to the playoffs, assuming they haven't qualified for Euro 2020 via their actual qualifying group.
But regardless of anything, Joe,
not like you can break water.
At the end of it, if you top your league, you're going to you'll hit then the playoff system. The overall winner, which will be League A, B, C, and D.
Yeah.
If then, as I said before, if you win that league, you automatically then qualify. Hit the playoff for the Euros. That's what you get.
When you say winning the league, what do you mean?
You win the League B.
You get one from pot one, one from pot three, and it's a three-team group, and you play them each home and away, and you got four games, and then if we win our league, we get promoted to League A.
I don't understand. So if we win our little group with the other two teams, let's say it's
not... No, not necessarily that. If you win your league...
Yeah, I was going to say, so if we win our league, say we've Northern Ireland and Wales, and we come out of that group...
Say you win all four games. That's the way that you can maybe explain it a little bit. But if you win all four games, you give yourself a great chance of winning the league, because it's going to come down to goal difference and everything will probably...
So what do you have to do to win your league? We have a little group within a league. What do you have to do to win the league, to win League B? You don't know. No, that's fine. You don't know.
Yeah, you've killed me there. No, let's not go into
that. No, you screwed up.
Well, not that we need it, clearly, after that. But let's go to Kevin Kilbane for an explanation of Nations League Round 2. Kevin Kilbane.
There, hi, Joe. How you feeling? It was you that was complicating me through it all. Win your game, you hit the playoffs, that was it. You complicated it all for me, Joe. I stand by that.
No, you really nailed it that night, I felt.
I know. That's it. It's one of my finest pieces of stuff with on off the ball, isn't it?
Where are you at the moment? I lose track of your life.
I know, I lose track of my own life, yes. I am down in the south of England somewhere, yeah.
England?
Yeah.
I thought you were in Canada.
No, who said I'm in Canada?
You did.
No.
That was weeks ago.
Weeks ago. So you've been in England for the last couple of weeks?
I was in Ireland last week, wasn't I? I was doing Champions League stuff.
Oh, so you were, sorry, yeah, okay.
The man is back on the ice this Sunday.
Is that right?
Yes, I am, back on the ice this week, yeah.
It's the grand finale of Dancing on Ice.
So you're doing like a major group dance thingy, is it?
Well, it's not a major group dance, it's a bit of an individual thing, so it's probably about 40 seconds, I would say, a minute or so on the ice this week.
I was on Instagram earlier, and his better half had a video up.
Yeah.
And he was doing some remarkable moves on the ice, sort of lunges on the ice. Sensational.
Kev, you've been practicing, using the time off to get back.
I haven't. First time back on today in 4 weeks, I think now. Yeah, first time back on. So it took me about 20 minutes to get myself going again, yeah, but it was good. It's actually good. I'm serious, it is.
Good man. No, listen, I have no doubts.
Yeah.
So Wales, Kev, Finland, Bulgaria. We don't need to go through the logistical process, but we know they're in our
group. We're sick of Wales, aren't we, at this stage?
Yeah, very sick of Wales. Very sick of Wales.
Yeah. I think, you're playing those home and away, you take your chances, won't you? That's the way that I'd look at it there. I said before the last group that maybe Wales was a team that we could definitely beat. I think they proved it in the last Nations League in the last qualifying that they were way better than us, didn't they? So that was maybe that's the worry going into that game with how they're playing and maybe how Ryan Giggs has got them set up. But the other two, you take your chance again. I mean, you know, Finland are at the Euros; they're a decent side. I know that, but I don't know. I mean, we're going into the unknown. I think with Bulgaria we always seem to play Bulgaria maybe up to about 10 years ago. We haven't played them for such a long time now. So them and Finland, they're a bit of the unknown to us. And I think that's a good thing.
It is so difficult to predict what will happen because we don't know what position Stephen Kenny will be in by then. If he's had the players together in June for two and a half weeks, had three or four games, he sort of got through the initial period. They all know him. They know what he's about. If he hasn't and Ireland qualify, which is what everybody wants, he's coming in. He'll probably have 3 days with these players. before the first match, and that'll be a big decision from what he does with the likes of an Aaron Connolly, maybe Troy Parrott, maybe even some of the players who haven't got a huge amount of time under Mick McCarthy, somebody like Alan Brown. Like, do you play those players in these six games, give them that experience, so by the time you come to the World Cup qualifiers, you have players who've got a good amount of international football under your belt? Or does he have to stick with the tried and trusted? Because there is, it's complicated, but these games are actually important.
Yeah, I'd imagine it would be a number of changes off the back of, hopefully we're coming off the back of the Euros, aren't we? That's what we're all hoping for. But if that's not the case, there'll be major changes before Stephen Kenny takes over. And I genuinely do imagine when Stephen Kenny announced his first squad, I'd say we'll be looking at a lot of players who will be totally new faces to the squad. And we'll be looking at a new picture going forward. I think that's the way it's going to be. So there'll be, how are we all going to view this? Are we going to view this, the Nations League, as Stephen Kenny's chance just to blood all the youngsters so we're going forward with that? Or give him the chance to blood these youngsters? And I'm not necessarily saying throwing games, but we're all going to be of an opinion that these players are coming in with so little experience that we're going to have to give them a chance to go on and just to go on and prove themselves going forward. And that's what I think will happen. I think that realistically, Stephen Kenny's going to blood these younger players or these new faces, give them the chance to shine, and it will be about the World Cup beyond it. I think that has to be the way. I think we've got to give Stephen Kenny two or three campaigns now.
Yeah, it's very hard to say that that's wrong. And yet, you know, your patience is a funny thing when you get into the reality of losing games and bad performances, because it was the Nations League that did it for Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane, as much as we all went into it thinking it wasn't that big a deal. And if you listen to Martin O'Neill around the time of the Welsh games in particular, was it the Denmark game? Whichever it was. But he was almost saying, but hang on, these are just friendlies, really. Mm. And it didn't come across that way. So that's a dilemma for Kenny, for sure, to try and navigate.
I'd like to think that we could definitely look at something like Michael O'Neill's model up in Northern Ireland and what they did when Nathan probably knows a stat on it, but I think he lost his first six games. He lost a number of games to start with, and there was still maybe a little bit of pressure on him to try and get that next victory, but it was about building a squad, building a team that was going to be going forward. And then we know what happened. Then he got them to the Euros in 2016. So I would like to think that there would be that little bit of leeway given to Stephen that, look, of course, they are the so-called meaningful friendlies now, but realistically, it is about getting as many of these younger players with little experience on the pitch and getting them game time. Mm. That's what it's about now. And I think that we'll see the benefit of that in two or three campaigns beyond this.
And Wales can be a bit of an example as well, because you think back to that 4-1 defeat, which really started the rot for Martin O'Neill. That was the game that Ampadu started. Yeah. Harry Wilson was getting involved. Yeah. They brought through Ben Whitburn, who was starting to do things at Liverpool at the time. Like, Ryan Giggs went out, and probably even still has been given a little bit of time, even though results haven't kicked on from that win over Ireland, because they brought through so many young players, and certain guys will step up straight away.
Yeah.
So it'll be incumbent, I think, on Stephen Kenny. People will want him to bring through a Jason Malumbi in the middle of midfield. They'll want to see these players. They want to see what Aaron Connolly can do. Mm. In fact, he's probably going to get more criticism if he didn't, if he sort of flipped on what everyone expects and thinks, actually, these are important qualifiers, I'm going to stick with the players you all know.
Yeah, it's true. In the shorter term, Kev, because it's like so hard to predict where we'll be come September, the word from UEFA today with the coronavirus and the Slovakia game was that they're going to make last-minute decisions, which is fair enough, really, under the circumstances, because none of us know how this story is going to change over the days and weeks ahead. As a footballer, if you were going to Slovakia, would you prefer to play a match in front of 2,000-4,000 Irish fans and the Slovakian fans, a rocking stadium, or would you fancy playing it behind closed doors, nobody in there?
I think it would be a huge advantage for us if there was no crowd there. Absolutely would be. Yeah, I do think that. I think we'd all, you know, even when I would have gone away to some of the hostile environments, you look back and you think they were great games to play in, but the home side does get a little bit of momentum from the home crowd's atmosphere that's been generated. So I do. I mean, when you've watched behind closed doors games, Joe, when you've seen them, there's been a number of them that have been played in European competition that we would have covered, I would have covered, and you've watched them, and they're kind of nothing games, the low key games, they're almost like practice games that's how they turn out. But this is obviously a little bit different. And I think that would only help us if that were to be the case, if we would go there and we were to play behind closed doors. I think it'd help us, yeah.
We've just been talking about the potential selections that Mick McCarthy faces. And the big news today, I guess, is that Seamus Coleman is out. He missed the Denmark game as well through suspension. So like his last Ireland game was that red card against Switzerland. It means it's very straightforward. Matt Doherty was in very much back to his very best where he got to last season. We'll play it right back. The midfield selection, because we don't know what will happen with McLean, but in the middle of midfield, Glenn Whelan, you'd expect, is playing football, will play. Conor Howard's not. And we're just talking about James McCarthy, and traditionally McCarthy plays his best football at the base of midfield. If McCarthy's willing to come, and he's playing every single week and seems to be playing really good stuff for Crystal Palace, could you play him in a three-man midfield with Whelan at the base, McCarthy and Hendrick? Like, is that a role that James McCarthy could flourish in?
I prefer to play James McCarthy and have two players in advance of him. And if he's fit and playing the way that he's been playing regularly enough for Crystal Palace like he has, I'd play him, and I'd be prepared to leave Glenn Whelan out and leave him in the squad. That's what I would do. I'd prefer to have two more advanced, more attack-minded players, not necessarily gung-ho players that's prepared to continuously run beyond, but certainly two more advanced players with James McCarthy sitting at the base of midfield, because he's been playing now. He's been fit now for, he's probably, must be eight months or so now, Nathan, isn't he? I mean, I know he didn't play the back end of the season with Everton and he had to then get himself fully fit, but he's been more or less fit now for such a long time. He's played a number of games. I personally would go with McCarthy, but because of how Glenn Whelan has performed, he probably was, you could make an argument for him being our best player in the last campaign, couldn't you? And he actually did a good job for us. I think it was maybe a bit of a relief for him getting back in the squad, but personally, I think James McCarthy will be better equipped with two more advanced players ahead of him, yeah.
That's interesting, because I do think Mick is very wedded to Glenn Whelan and really values Glenn Whelan.
Yeah, and he's loyal. He's loyal, and I totally understand that Glenn Whelan would be playing in there as well. I think it'd be difficult, though, to get James... Whenever James McCarthy, whenever he's played for Ireland, as a more advanced midfielder, when he's played as in a three-man midfield, he's been given the job of getting out to close down wide areas, I think you've taken away from his sort of game. And personally, I think he's more of a sitter. He likes to sit at the base of midfield. He likes to break things up and keep it simple. That's the way I would like to see James McCarthy playing. I wouldn't like to see him in a more advanced position, no.
And even in that holding role, the idea of James McCarthy for Ireland has always been a lot better than the reality of James McCarthy for Ireland. Even now, when you think of him sitting there, he's controlling games, he's playing nice little passes to Howran and to Jeff Hendrick, he's starting things off. Whereas, aside from a couple of games at Euro 2016, quite often games have just bypassed him completely.
Same applies to Hendrick, unfortunately, So that's where we are. A few quick ones in the world going on, because we haven't talked to you in the last while. The Troy Parrott situation is interesting at Spurs. Mourinho again today, 2-3 minutes of Mourinho's press conference was about Parrott. And I suspect, a bit like lots of managers, and we've even seen, you know, akin to Trapattoni and Wes Hoolihan, the more they're asked sometimes about a player, the more they dig in. So he brought him on for, in effect, 3 minutes at the weekend.
I was going to say 30 seconds, but yeah, 3 minutes, yeah.
Plus out of time, 30 seconds plus out of time. Which really, and he said he's going to be on the bench tomorrow against Norwich, but that felt like a political statement. That felt like, here you go, put him on. This is all I've got. Message to Daniel Levy. Yeah. I didn't like that, actually. I don't think an 18-year-old should be used in that way. But at the same time, I think Mourinho's entitled to say that a 17, 18-year-old is not ready. And I feel like we're all getting a bit ahead of ourselves here.
Well, I think we all are. But I think that Spurs' injury crisis up front has probably put him in a different light, hasn't it? That perhaps he should have been given a bit more game time. But the problem is, you're spot on, Joe. He did it at Man United with Luke Shaw when he was continuously asked questions about Luke Shaw, wasn't he? He dug his heels in. And then he almost said, well, look, he needs me, but his words, whatever he did say, but he needs me on the touchline to guide him through a game, which was nonsense, wasn't it, really? And this is what's happening with Troy Parrott now, and it's wrong, it's not right, and I'm just hoping that if he is given that game time, he scores a goal or two or whatever it will be, and then it's almost he's in there on his own merit then, and that's the only way it can be. But Mourinho digs his heels in, and he's been a constant, he's a manager that's constantly done this, that when he's asked questions about certain players, I remember going back to his Chelsea days when he had Joel Cole. He used to do the same with Joel Cole. He was asked, why aren't you playing Joel Cole? He's your flair player. He gives you something different. And Joe Cole was in that same boat as well, where he's used a lot off the bench. So he's got history of it. So, you know, as you say, the more he's asked questions, the more he's going to do it and dig his heels in.
Yeah, I guess, you know, if he was here, he would say Joe Cole, Luke Shaw, totally different propositions to a 17-year-old. They're established players, so... I don't know. We'll see if he gets a. I mean, if he's going to get some game time, you would think tomorrow against Norwich in the cup, that's the time to give him 20 minutes. Ian Wright was saying on Match of the Day, throw him in there, give him a chance. But again, Ian Wright probably hasn't seen Troy Parrott play, so you know it's just become
I'd
this
say
thing.
I'd say that's fair. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, Nathan's in a better position. Nathan's seen him a lot. Nathan's would have seen him playing under 21 football.
Well, that's not even a lot. You know, that's the thing. Like, he's played four or five games for 21s, and he's played out on the left hand side in the majority of them. He's not even playing in that central role.
And I get that he's not played, and it's something that I've continuously said when, you know, there's a huge outcry to get our youngsters into the international setup with Mick McCarthy, the senior setup, should I say, that look, how can you be picking players when they've not even played senior football? They've been playing under 23 football, under 21 football. It's a massive jump to all of a sudden you're playing competitive football against I was going to say real men, but do you know, like, when you're playing men's football, when it actually means something, that's when you start to judge and you start to gauge a player, and that's what I've always felt. Maybe that's been the case across the history of the game, I suppose. It's not necessarily you're too young. The point being is that he's not been given any game time to go and flourish.
Pete has texted in saying, how could Killer be anywhere but in the UK? He's in full-on Cheltenham mode already.
I wish I was, yeah. I'm way out of the loop with Cheltenham as well. I'm out of the loop with so much, but I'm way out of the loop with Cheltenham.
Well, the last time I saw you on Instagram on a flight, and I thought you were still out there, but of course you were back for Virgin last week. So what game is, because we've just seen Liverpool full-time, 2-0 loss. Did you catch much of the Atletico game?
No, I covered the... what game was I doing that evening? Was that Napoli, I think, I was doing that evening? Okay. Yeah, did Dortmund the week before, I think it was. Yeah, so, no, I caught a lot of the game. I saw the goals and things like that, but I actually listened to a lot of the stuff that you were saying around it as well, and I think
Damien Delaney
on that
was
evening,
in,
didn't
he? Damien Delaney was in, yeah.
Yeah, Damien, and it was how good they have been at doing that, and you could actually see them going to Anfield and shutting up shop again and doing a job at Anfield, but I don't know, I just think Liverpool at home... The record speaks for itself, doesn't it? I think they might get through that game, actually.
Barry wants to know, can Kev settle the Jason McAteer, Brian Kerr kerfuffle that Nathan Murphy instigated over the weekend? I added in that part, I'm sorry. Okay. He's off the ball's man on the inside. He knows the true story.
What did Nathan say first? What
you should have seen him, Kev.
Against...
He was stirring it.
No.
It was sad.
Brian Kerr was at our road show, Kevin, and having gone to the effort of reading Jason McAteer's book, I went to the effort of reading the full book, he does sort of... have a little bit of a go at Brian Kerr. The point that Brian Kerr brought up, Roy Keane's return, and I mentioned how McAteer had said in his book, Kev, that Brian had suggested that Keane and McAteer do a joint press conference, which Brian said was complete and utter bullshit.
That's a quote.
I honestly, I'm being deadly serious now. He's not sitting on the fence. I have never heard that before. So I've never read Jason's book, and when I was in the squad at the time, I never heard that mentioned, so no. No, I didn't hear that mentioned at all, no.
That's fair enough.
We'll let him away with that.
We'll let you away. You don't have to wade into that one. So listen, our time is done. When are we talking to you again? When will we check in?
I don't know, whenever JP's on. JP keeps on dropping us the odd message here and there. Most of the time it has been no, and I take that. So I'm sorry I've not been on, but I'll be on. I'll be on in the next while, definitely, okay. Yeah.
And is it this Saturday or this Sunday that we're seeing you skate again?
So, well, Joe, the show has always been on a Sunday, so why would it be a Saturday?
Come on, Joe.
It doesn't change, Joe. Come on, just show a little bit of interest here and there.
who's going to win, Kev? Because the lad from Diversity on Sunday, oh my God.
I heard he got a 40.
40, a well-deserved as well.
He's class, isn't he? He's class. Do you know what? I think Joe Swash might win. He might
very
win.
Very popular.
Yeah. As in the popular vote will go to Joe Swash.
Yeah, popularity vote. Yeah, that's it comes down to the vote in the final, doesn't it? Probably out of the generally are decent. They're all decent. But I'd love to see Libby win. I'd love to see Libby Clegg win, yeah.
Okay, very good.
Just before we go, Kev, remind us again what Ireland need to do in this Nations League to get a playoff for the World Cup.
You tell me, Ned. Ned, you're the expert on everything. Any man that can wear an orange jumper on air like that, you're an expert on everything, yeah.
Kev Coban, great to talk to you. Thanks a mil.
Thanks, lad.
All right, good man. Thanks for taking the time. Cheers. Kev Coban there. short break. I'll take a short break. We've got to get to Raphael Honigstein in a second, and I'll update you on all the live football. Liverpool 2-0 lost this evening at Stamford Bridge.
Paddy Power and the Football Show, the greatest football partnership since Duff and Heskey.
Welcome back. So every night this week, we're giving away a €100 one for all voucher. On Saturday, we'll have a grand prize of flights, tickets to the Paddy Power Stayers Hurdle Day next Thursday, 12th of March. You'll be flown to Cheltenham. You enjoy breakfast, Jury's Hotel, brought to Jury's Racecourse, enjoy one of the best days in the racing calendar, transferred back to the airport afterwards, and then flown back to Dublin by nightfall, all with thanks to our Cheltenham partner, Paddy Power. To win, just tell us phony or pony. Rules are simple. Three horses, tell us which is the real horse, i.e. the pony. We have Tiger Roll, Breakfast Roll, Kitten Soft Roll. Pick out the real horse from that list. Text us your name and answer to 53106. We'll pick a winner who'll go into our draw on Saturdays off the ball between 3 and 5pm. Again, all the thanks to Paddy Power. Cheltenham's coming home. Stamford Bridge, as I mentioned, 2-0 win for Chelsea. 1-1 currently between Reading and Sheffield United. Newcastle 3-1 up away to West Brom. Now, let's go to the Athletics. Raphael Honigstein, sorry, a bit later than planned. Raphael, how you doing?
Absolutely fine, how are you?
Very well. So we saw the scenes between Bayern Munich and Hoffenheim at the weekend. Quite unusual, to say the least. You might just sum up generally what happened in that game on that day, and then we'll get into the bigger picture.
Okay, so with the game being 4-0 up for Bayern away to Hoffenheim in the second half, Bayern Munich fans put up a couple of banners insulting Dietmar Hopp, the benefactor and de facto owner of Hoffenheim, also insulting the German FA, or making reference to the German FA and the collective punishment that they declared on Dortmund fans not being able to go to Hoffenheim for 2 years. This was effectively a solidarity action in solidarity with the Dortmund fans who'd been banned, and other fans in the Bundesliga who'd made similar statements in the past, as a result of which the referee first sent the team off, got them all into the dressing room. They took down one of the banners, the teams came back, then a second banner came up, then the teams again went off, and when they came back on, they decided to just play out the last 13 minutes, almost in protest against the protest, just passing the ball to each other or just standing around winding down the clock. As you can imagine, there was a huge reaction to that. All sorts of rhetoric from both sides, not really helping the situation, and a sense that the ultras and the German FA and some of the clubs are really not on the same page here.
Yeah, I mean, I was struck by the Bayern reaction more than anything. So, in short here, Germany and the Bundesliga famously has the 50-plus-1 rule. So fans effectively own 50% of clubs plus one share. And it is to stop wealthy owners coming in and running the club to their liking. And from afar, it seems like a fantastic situation. I dare say Premier League fans look on it enviously. So Hoffenheim and Dietmar Hopp, their owner, one of the very few clubs, three I think, but certainly one of the very few clubs who've managed to, in a sense, circumvent these rules, and other German fans don't like it.
That's essentially it. They don't like the fact that he's taken this village club and pumped money into it to the point where they can get into the Bundesliga and even get into the Champions League. They don't like the principle behind it, but it is also more personal. Personal in the sense that he has been very active and almost vindictive, some might say, in clamping down on dissent. When Christian Heidel, the Mainz general manager at the time, when Klopp was there, said that he doesn't like this idea of, you know, somebody just basically bankrolling a club, Hopp reacted very strongly and said this is almost like discrimination and racism. And basically that kind of narrative, that kind of trying to clamp down on also the dissent and making it almost seem as if it's criminal or unlawful, that seems to have taken root. And that in itself is what some of the ultras are protesting. Mm. So the fact that Bayern fans have taken over now from Dortmund fans, who've been the most vocal about this, is really not so much about Hopp himself, even not so much about the principal himself, but about the way he has dealt and the way that the German FA have dealt with what they consider the ultras as a legitimate form of protest, even if the language used and some of the symbolism used is, of course, up for debate.
When you look at the other two Bundesliga clubs not owned by the fans, Rafa, in Bayer Leverkusen and Wolfsburg, two clubs that were founded as works clubs, how then was an exception made back in 2015 for Hopp to take this majority voting share?
The exception was made because even under the existing rules, you are allowed to effectively take over the shares if you can demonstrate that you've been consistently been supporting the club financially for more than 20 years, which in Hopp's case he was able to do. Again, a decision that was hugely criticized. Of course, now there's a worse, in inverted commas, case in the Bundesliga with RB Leipzig, who have gone almost unashamedly and just set up a club with no real fan ownership at all. They pay lip service to the 50+1 rule, but it's very difficult to become a member and even more difficult to have any real say as a member. So in a way, that's taken some of the heat off him, some of the flack off him. But because only last week or 10 days ago, the German FA confirmed that the Dortmund fans would be banned for 2 years from Hoffenheim, that's when we've seen this wave of protests in all sorts of stadiums. So whether people agree or disagree with Hopp as a person, Hoffenheim as a person, is almost not that relevant anymore. Yeah. Now it's about the protest against what they see as the unfair clamping down on their dissent.
I have to say, I think they have a point. It's utterly ridiculous, it seems from here, that they wouldn't be able to protest. I mean, okay, the language wasn't ideal. They called him a son of a bee, but I'm told that is a more severe insult in Germany than it might be over here. But still, there are bad things said in stadiums, and the right to protest surely should be protected, so that he would ban the Dortmund supporters. I'm not surprised the Bayern supporters said, well, hang on, we're going to show a solidarity with our fellow German football fans. So in that context, I was really surprised to see the Bayern players, the Bayern hierarchy coming down onto the pitch, applauding the Hoffenheim fans, a show of solidarity on the pitch with Dietmar Hopp, the Hoffenheim owner. I would have thought, you know, the Bayern fans can't have loved their own club, their own official club players and hierarchy siding with Hopp here. Are Bayern coming in for criticism over the last couple of days?
Of course, by some of the fans, by some of the ultras concerned, they didn't, I think it's fair to say, expect that kind of reaction. They're saying, you know, insults in football have always been a commonplace. Opposition players, opposition teams, the referee, all sorts of people are being insulted, and the games are not called off for that. In fact, the point that they're making is the games haven't been called off or suspended for much more serious things like racism in the past. Mm. They felt that they were being almost like just quoting what others have said. So by quoting, you know, those insults and quoting the banner as the Gladbach fans did with the crosshairs, they were basically just trying to say that this is a legitimate protest. Now, I think because a very sensitive political climate in Germany with, you know, racism and all things kind of thrown together, I think it was easily misunderstood, and those who wanted, I think, not to have this kind of fan activism found it easy to make it sound as if these are basically criminals or kind of terrorists. And that was some of the language used, you know, yobs, criminals, masks, masked people, they're anonymous, they're insulting people. And the fans feel really misunderstood. They released another statement today. Some of the Bayern fans going through all the reasons why they used it, while acknowledging that it perhaps could have been done more elegantly, they still feel that this is a huge overreaction. Now, I can tell you that there was a lot of expectation that something even more dramatic would happen today when Bayern played at Schalke in the Cup. The Schalke fans did put up a statement attacking the German FA for what they see as double standards with a collective punishment. But apart from that, there were no anti-Hop insults. And I think the background to this was that Schalke had very clearly said if they see anything that they consider hateful or discriminatory or overstepping the mark, they would suspend the game by themselves. So that obviously had a sort of a chilling effect. And if you want to throw this forward a little bit more, I think there is a genuine small sense of optimism that both sets of camps having come to the brink almost are now stepping back a little bit and will consider a much more measured dialogue going forward.
Just if you can very quickly, Raf, because the clock's just suddenly come against us, I did want to ask you, is there a sense that the 50+1 situation, which seems, you know, again, to have so many positive aspects, is that under threat? Like, are there billionaires circling? Are there people in German football who want to get this, you know, this kind of antiquated business of 50+1 out the door?
Well, the ultras are saying it is under threat because we have clubs circumventing it. So that in itself is showing that something's not working here. And we, they say, as normal clubs, inverted commas, are at a disadvantage as long as there are RB Leipzig and Wolfsburgs and Hoffenheim's in this league. There are some people in the media and in German clubs who say if we open ourselves up to investors, we could be the richest league in the world. We are the richest economy in Europe. Why aren't we doing this? But the fans are very resistant. So this is very much the background and the heart of this discussion. Right now, though, there's no serious majority, I think, for changing it because they know that the grassroots resistance is too strong.
Okay, brilliant. Listen, Rafa Langstein from The Athletic. Thanks so much, Rafa.
Thank you.
Cheers. Interesting story. I mean, geez, all they can do is protect that as much as they can because there's no going back.
Hell no. But the way that they have clamped down on the supporters is just insane.
I couldn't believe the Bayern players and hierarchy clapping the Hoffenheim fans.
Going through the protocols that you would assume are only there for racist incidents.
Yeah.
Against a billionaire owner.
Yeah.
Like, go to Old Trafford. You wouldn't want to hear what's said about the Glazers.
I know. All very tame by comparison. So Chelsea 2-0 full-time, Reading and Sheffield United is about to go 1-1 in the FA Cup, and Newcastle hanging on a bit against West Brom, 3-2 finishing the end.
Dave McGoldrick with a goal for Sheffield United, first of the season, badly needed, at long last.
Just in time.
3 defeats and 4 for Liverpool.
I know, it is funny, the Atletico result, does it just change something somehow? So interesting times. OTBM, back at you tomorrow morning. All our social channels, OTB Sports Radio via the Go Loud app. Tomorrow, the lads have Brian Howard on the show. They have Kieran Donaghy and they have a Mayo footballer and basketball player, Dana Finn. And then tomorrow night, Wednesday night rugby, Dan McDonald in as well. Tom Dunn is on the way next.
Paddy Power and the Football Show. The greatest football partnership since Diouf and Heskey.